We get a few mixed messages on the subject of forest and other wildland fire. On one hand, we're told to take extreme care when we're out in the woods, and we watch as millions of dollars are spent fighting the fires that do start. On the other hand, we hear that fire is a natural factor in the healthy growth of forests. The approaches are not mutually exclusive. There are times and places when and where fire is appropriate, and plenty where it is not welcome. So here's our chance to visit with someone who knows forests and their workings well. Dr. Kerry Metlin is a forest ecologist at TNC, the Nature Conservancy in Medford. He's also involved with the ongoing Ashland Forest Resiliency Project. And you've got an event coming up tonight that spurred our interest in bringing you in here. We should point out that's a pub talk sponsored by ScienceWorks Hands-On Theater that'll be at Howie's in Medford starting at 6:30 tonight. But right here in the morning, here's a chance to warm up for it. So let's talk first, though, about the Ashland Forest Resiliency Project. And for the folks who may be hearing about this for the first time, what is it and where?
Great. Thanks, Jeffrey. And thanks for having me. So the Ashland Forest Resiliency Project is a project that's it's good for Ashland and it's good for the forest, because what it's doing is it's focusing on protecting many of the values that we have at risk in the watershed, our clean water, some really interesting threatened species and wildlife habitat, human life and property, which of course is embedded in the matrix all around the watershed, as well as a highly diverse plant and animal system, and legacy pine, Douglas fir, sugar pine, black oak, Pacific madrone, all of these species that we have in this watershed in abundance, and really in a condition which is fairly unique across the southwestern Oregon. So we're protecting those values by doing fuel reduction treatments in strategic places that allow fire workers to actually help control wildfires when they happen so that they don't burn with the sorts of uncharacteristic severities that we think is not necessarily desirable.
Is that severity caused by us putting out fires over the years, that we allow the fuels to build up in ways they would not have if the system were essentially human-free?
So our work, the Nature Conservancy's work, has really come a long way in documenting the historic fire frequencies. And so what we found is that, yes, before we started really modifying the landscape, managing the landscape, fires were extremely frequent. At a given site in the Ashland Watershed, we found as many as, an average of every 16 years there was a fire at a given site, but as frequent as every 3 years there was fire somewhere in the Ashland Watershed until the late 1800s, when a combination of factors, grazing and fire suppression and just human habitation, really dramatically decreased that fire frequency. There were a couple of big fires. 1910 is a good example, when a big fire in 1959 burned up into the lower watershed. But we've really worked hard, yes, at putting out those fires. And so now we do have a situation with a lot of dense fuel that is prone to burning at a high severity.
I'm curious to know how you document the fire frequency, though. I mean, it's not like you I suppose you have newspaper reports, but is there something up there that lets you know when fires happen?
Well, absolutely. And so especially ponderosa pine are very resistant to fire, because they have this very thick, very, very resistant bark that insulates the living tissue so that it doesn't cook, essentially, and die. And so that's great. These trees can get to be very old with very frequent fire, as long as the fire's not too severe. But if you get an accumulation of fuel, it can burn through that protective bark and injure the cambium, the living layer of tissue just under the bark. And as long as it doesn't kill the entire tree, then the tree will then heal over that wound slowly. And then when the next fire comes, it will be more prone to scarring again. And so what we get is these very long fire scar records within an individual tree, that then we look at the patterns of growth, good years and bad years, to determine what years the fire actually happened. And we can then determine when fires happen, compare those with lots of trees from across the entire watershed. So we're sampling about 300 trees in the Ashland watershed alone. Compare that to growth rates from thousands of trees regionally, and pretty soon you have a picture of how these forests lived and functioned with fire.
Does it give you not just indication of points in time, but also points in space? In other words, you can figure out, it sounds like you can figure out where in the watershed the fires happen.
Well, the interesting thing about fire scars is they give you a record of where a fire happened. What they don't give you a record of is where a fire didn't happen, or where a fire happened, but you didn't necessarily scar that a tree. And so they kind of give you a minimum fire interval and a minimum spatial distribution. But these 300 trees that we're sampling in the Ashland watershed, they are distributed across the entire watershed, across many different topographic positions, various biophysical settings, to try to say as much as possible about that spatial extent.
So fire is obviously natural in the ecosystem in the West, and it was apparently promoted and used by the original inhabitants of the region for thousands of years. So
Absolutely. Why
is it that the white settlers didn't really know much about it or just chose not to use it that way?
Well, I think there's probably a lot of reasons. One of the primary reasons that fire frequencies decreased across the West, actually, was grazing. So removal of the fine fuels with large herds made it so that fires didn't spread quite as well as they would have. And then, of course, you know, we have a strong timber-based economies here in the West, and so fire was historically seen as a threat to that particular asset. And then, of course, when fires were relatively easy to put out, it wasn't as clear that perhaps we should let some burn in order to keep it so that fires were easier to put out. And so very slowly a situation arose, and then that situation has been exacerbated by longer, drier fire seasons. And so now here we are today, and we can just look to the south a little ways to the southwest and see fires can be quite large, quite extreme, and potentially have type-converting impacts that clearly we want to avoid.
Kerry Metlin's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He's a forest ecologist for the Nature Conservancy in Medford, also one of the participants in the Ashland Forest Resiliency Project. You can join us here on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782 by email jx@jeffnet.org. I'm curious about the grazing that you were describing. So in some ways, with the removal of the small fuels on the forest floor, does grazing mimic fire in that sense? Does it have any ecological effect that's similar?
You know, you could potentially run down that thought train. And some of the work that the Nature Conservancy is involved in vernal pools, people have tried to figure out how in vernal pools there's these threatened fairy shrimp that live in them, and they don't like a lot of grass thatch. And so fire, it is thought, historically kept the grass thatch out of these seasonally wet pools and allowed the fairy shrimp to thrive. And then grazing also has a similar effect in that it consumes that thatch and allows the fairy shrimp to do okay. That's not to say there aren't other impacts of grazing that are unlike fire and that may not be quite as desirable. But yes, to some extent, you can have some of that effect with grazing.
It seems like we've been talking about the healthy effects of fire, the benefits to the forest ecosystem for a couple of decades now anyway, and there's ongoing talk about, well, we should really be reintroducing fire to the ecosystem, but it certainly hasn't happened overnight.
No, absolutely not.
No. So what's the major set of obstacles here?
I think there are clearly lots of obstacles to reintroducing fire, and especially reintroducing fire at scale, even though that's what's perhaps the most necessary for living more comfortably with fire. One of the primary factors is that strict fuel reduction treatments that just treat the very small diameter material tend to be fairly expensive. That's not to say that you can't reduce fuels by taking some of the medium-sized trees as well, and those can help, as in Ashland Forest Resiliency Project, help pay for more treatments on the ground, but that hasn't always been done. And, you know, just societally, sometimes it's difficult to burn because you've got burn windows that are fairly narrow. So with a controlled burn, what we want to do is light a fire under conditions where you're going to have desired impacts and keep smoke away from towns. And those opportunities are relatively few and far between. And so that makes it challenging to get much fire on the ground.
Let's take a call. We have Lon in Eugene on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking fire in the forest ecosystem with Dr. Kerry Metlin.
Good morning. I just wanted to make a point with Jerry. He was talking about the reasons why the white settler might not appreciate the fires and where the native population groups would have. Most native population groups were rather mobile. They could, in fact, they commuted up and down the valley or throughout Oregon, depending on the needs and the season. it would be relatively easy to build a fire or start a fire, allow it to burn, if you could move your home, where the white settler was typically building a structure and being more permanently placed, where fires got more out of control, might destroy their backyard, so to speak. They couldn't really adapt nearly as well as the native population groups. It was just an additional point.
A good point at that. Thanks for that, Lon. So essentially being nomadic helps you because you can kind of move with the fire and stay out of the fire's way, for that matter, too.
I think that's a fantastic point, and, you know, it really highlights one of the primary factors that the Ashland Forest Resiliency Project, TNC with partners, is working to protect, you know, homes and property and, for example, our municipal watershed, because that's where we get our water through the entire year.
You know, when you were talking about the poor economics of just removing some of the smaller diameter fuels, you can't sell those things off for trees. Obviously, there is some timber sale aspect to the Ashland Forest Resiliency Project. In a large scale fire, are there some large trees that would not survive? Something that, under than ponderosa pine, perhaps.
Well, in the severe fires that we're seeing contemporaneously, there are conditions under which the large trees survive, and usually those are more humid conditions, maybe earlier season or later season fires, or fires that are burning at night. And then there are conditions where even the big trees get burned up, and even the big ponderosa pine. And that's a situation that clearly I think we want to avoid. It takes 500 years to grow a 500-year-old tree. But yes, the Ashland Forest Resiliency Project did generate some receipts from selling commercial-sized timber. In fact, $1.3 million has been that now, because we're working in a stewardship agreement, turned back into more work on the ground. So more non-commercial thinning and burning the piles of fuels that the Lomecatse Restoration Project has piled up so that we can really help deal with the fuel problem more comprehensively by utilizing those dollars.
Let's take another call. We have Helga and Ashland on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Carrie Metlin.
Hi. During the last half hour, there was a question about slash and why not turn it into mulch for the forest floor, as the forest would naturally do, letting its little debris rot, even the big logs rot, and we take away the big logs. Now, once again, you're talking about, well, we have to put it to use, or we have to burn it so that it doesn't cause fire. I mean, what are we doing to replenish the soil? It just doesn't make any sense. It could be chipped up. And
all right, let's find out from Carrie. Thanks for the call, Helga. Appreciate it.
Helga, that is a great question, and I think the key there was a little debris is key. And the other thing that I want to point out is actually the Ashland Forest Resiliency Project, the very large logs, the big old trees, when they come down, we leave them in place because they are really critical habitat for small mammals, for example, and feeding macroinvertebrates, insects, etc. But what we've got out there is more than a little debris, and given the certainty that wildfire will get into this system, what we need is that sort of a manageable fuel level, and when I say fuel, I do mean that debris on the forest floor. And so with pile burning, we consume some of it, but we don't remove all of it. And the other thing I want to point out is, well, first of all, that chipping is time-consuming, expensive, and requires you to move equipment into the forest where you're doing your work. And so that's also not really an option in the Ashland watershed. And then there are impacts of that chipping that actually can be pretty hard on the native herbaceous layer that we actually want to promote.
Impacts as in you're running equipment over it?
Well, equipment, but also if you put down a thick layer of chips, what's that do to your yard? It smothers all the plants that would be growing there. And those are plants that I think it's clear that are part of the system and we want to keep in the system.
So particularly with the Ashland Forest Resiliency Project, are you talking about a point at which you would actually be setting fires on the ground in the forest?
So the long-term objective, absolutely, would be to have fires burning in a way that would control the fuels and allow these forests to function in a way that they did historically. In the near term, we are doing some pile burning, and in the next year, we are hoping to implement some prescribed underburning, controlled burns under favorable conditions to have really a more natural consumption of fuels that leaves an appropriate amount of woody debris on the forest floor, but also keeps things a little more manageable should wildfire get into the system.
Sounds like a nerve-wracking process, though, because you're trying to make sure the conditions are just right, trying to get a good weather window, the breezes aren't going to come up and spread this thing, a whole bunch of things you're trying to control for.
It requires good partners, trust, and a lot of experience. And fortunately, we are working with partners, Loma Cotsi Restoration Project, the Forest Service, the City of Ashland, and the contractors, Grayback Forestry. These are all people who've actually spent a lot of time working with fire, and they need more experience. Absolutely, we all do, but they also need a chance to show what they can do.
So if you were the boss of all the forests, what would you be doing with fire? Would you be reintroducing it on a broad scale or limited use, or what would you be doing there?
If I was the boss of all the forests...
If you were the king of the forest, it's like the Wizard of Oz.
It's a dangerous question. But the research is clear that forests where we have allowed fire to burn under cool conditions or we have reintroduced fire under relatively cool conditions are less likely to burn severely under wildfire conditions where the fire workers aren't able to put that fire out. And so absolutely, much larger scale fire under more calm conditions to allow wildfire then to come through and behave not quite as severely.
So your pub talk tonight, I see, and pub talks, I guess, were first used in the Northwest by OMSI, the Oregon Museum of Science and Industry, but you're basically sitting in a bar with a bunch of people holding beers and talking about basically the same stuff we're talking about here. Tonight, I see, at 6:30 until 8 o'clock at Howie's on Front Street in Medford.
Absolutely, yeah. I'm really looking forward to it. Hopefully, we'll see some of you down there to talk about the Ashland Forest Resiliency Project, but also the cool research that TNC is letting me do to help help us think about doing forest restoration in a smart way across Southern Oregon.
TNC is the Nature Conservancy, and Kerry Metlin works for the Nature Conservancy in Medford. He's been our guest here on the Jefferson Exchange today. Kerry, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
That'll do it for this hour. We'll talk about immigration in hour number 2 of the Jefferson Exchange coming up shortly.